Professor Yeld, Mr. Shishi, Digi, and Ms. Winschot. We are today going to have, hopefully, an in-depth conversation about the outcomes of the National Benchmark Test Project, and we've invited Professor Yeld as a representative from HESA to speak to us about the benchmark test project. But we've also invited you from the department to get your sense of the findings and also some of your inputs and views on this matter. And really what we're meaning to do today is to really have a conversation about the very, very critical issue of both our schooling system as well as the readiness of school leavers when they get to tertiary institutions. As I said yesterday to members, we need to locate this discussion within its context, because what we're talking about here essentially are learners who have passed matric, who have passed matric well enough to be accepted at tertiary institutions, and then having been tested and found, shall we say, wanting to various degrees based on this benchmark test project. Now, clearly that concerns us as policymakers, simply because we're dealing with people who have actually performed quite well at the level of matric. For that reason, I thought it was important that we have this conversation between the people responsible for the National Benchmark Test Project, as well as the people responsible in the department, both for curriculum as well as the examination. So I want to welcome all of you here. And you're here really as experts who are going to talk to us about what you see are the difficulties and challenges in your various areas of expertise, but also to contextualize for us this debate a little bit more than I have already. So without any further ado, I do want to just indicate to you that a lot of members would be lost because our venue had to be changed at the last minute. So people will come in drips and drabs, no doubt. But those who are here, welcome to you. You would see that you have all of the handouts. Hopefully you would have received them yesterday, but if you haven't, they're here. Members of the press who are here, you're welcome to these documents, but please make sure that you speak to the committee secretary, because he has to ensure that members are all in receipt of copies first, and then whatever's left over, he will distribute to you, okay? Shall we start with you, Professor? You have a presentation for us, and perhaps you want to proceed with your presentation, and then after which we'll engage a little bit with you on the presentation. We'll then give over to the department to make a few comments and also do a presentation from their side, whereafter I think we'll have an open session where both yourself as well as the officials from the department can participate in the discussion as well. Okay? So let's proceed. with the presentation. You're all set up. You need somebody to operate that thing, or are you going to just do it? Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. And I'm just that thing looks like I can try the one next door.
Oh, okay. Can I be heard?
I can hear you, but I have a problem when people are speaking behind me because this room has not got very good acoustics. So please, those of you who do want to chat, please take it outside because otherwise I can't hear too well.
Right. Well, thank you very much, Chair. And if it's all right with you, I'd be very happy if there were questions of clarification, et cetera, as I go through. Okay, good. And I'm very pleased to see colleagues here from the Department of Education, in particular Ms. Ingevold. Penny, I think that you know much of this, et cetera, so you might want to also, while I'm going through it, make comments, but up to you, okay? Right, well, I'm speaking this morning very much from the perspective of higher education. And as I hope to make very clear, this whole initiative of the National Benchmark Test is about higher education trying to get its own house in order and do something about pass rates and graduation rates in our own sector. Okay, but I hope that will become clear as I go through. As you might know, Higher Education South Africa, HESA, commissioned the National Benchmark Test projects actually in 2003. The Vice Chancellors who then constituted HESA were very, very concerned at that time about what seemed to be quite high and steep escalation in the senior certificate pass rates, if you'll remember, in the early 2000s. And because of the grade inflation, higher education in South Africa, like in many countries, wanted them to look at something that was common across the higher education sector that they could understand what students were coming in with. And so that was the first and big reason, the demonstrable inefficiencies in higher education itself, and in particular our difficulties in identifying students' educational needs. One of the difficulties in a norm reference examination system like the National Senior Certificate or the Senior Certificate or school leaving examinations around the world is that they have to, in part at least, base the results on patterns of historical performance. It's simply what needs to be done. It's not wrong to do it. But what it can do sometimes is mask where students are actually performing. So while it's absolutely right for the one system, it is often not as helpful for the receiving system, the one further up, to know exactly at the level at which students are performing. Also, I mean, higher education has, I think, and this is my own view as a professional academic development practitioner, who's been concerned all the time about meeting students' educational needs at the point of entry and ensuring quality graduation, is that higher education has not been good at actually really the kind of curriculum flexibility that we need for such a diverse schooling system, from the very privileged to the very poor schools. They are delivering students understanding their different levels of preparedness. So it was a way of actually holding ourselves to account and to develop curriculum flexibility to deal with these needs. And then, of course, and quite legitimately, higher education was concerned about how to interpret the new certificate that was coming on and wanted to have something in place that would help them understand what level of performance in the new National Senior Certificate was. It wasn't meant to challenge the NSC, but it was meant to give us a lens through which to interpret results. So in summary then, the NBT is about higher education getting its own act in order. It's not about pointing fingers at the school system. And indeed, much of the recent publicity, I think, has tried to make that point, that in fact higher education is about its own health. But of course, other things get pulled into the equation, so I think some of the publicity has not been helpful. Others, I think, have tried to make the correct point. How does the NBT try and get its act in order? By providing information about the competence of entering students in terms of three core domains of knowledge and skills, and I'll talk about what those core domains are. But I just do want to say, and I don't think we've made this explicit enough in the past, the third bullet there, it's very important to note that what we in higher education really believe are the core domains of knowledge and skills might not be exactly the same as those that are deemed most salient by the school system, which is catering for a very wide range of schools. So it's inevitable. We are always going to show slightly different sets of results. And I honestly don't think that any of us would have conflict about that. What do we aim to do? Okay, to provide additional information to National Senior Certificate. The National Senior Certificate is the statutory minimum requirement to get into higher education. But higher education institutions have the right to set additional criteria, and they have the obligation to address past discriminatory practices that have resulted in poor performance for some students. The core domain areas are academic literacy and quantitative literacy and mathematics. So there's three. The first two of those are written in one test, and the third is mathematics. I just want to make it very clear that at the design phase of this national benchmark test, I'll just call it NBT for speed, okay? We did not decide to test in history and in life sciences and in physics and chemistry. We did not want to see it to be seen as a direct alternative to the National Senior Certificate. So the tests chosen are on the core underlying domain areas. And if you walk around to any academics in the country and you say, what do you really want your students to come into higher education with? They say, a decent level of math, because that is a linear kind of subject, you build on what you've done before, and an ability to deal with things that you read and the way you express yourself in a way that can be critical. That's really what people want, so that's what we test to.
Sorry? The core question, shouldn't that be whether the matric exam doesn't deliver that to you? I mean, if what
Professor Iloff was saying in his submission to the Higher Education Portfolio Committee last week, that most students in their first year are unable to read, unable to write and spell, and we're not talking about students who have passed a matric exam, which by all accounts I'm told is pitched at a fairly high and rigorous standard. The question that immediately comes to mind is, if these are your outcomes that you want to test, which is a degree of literacy and a degree of proficiency in mathematics and numeracy, I imagine, why is it that the matric results are not sufficient for your purposes?
Well, the colleague from the DOE can answer that too, but I didn't
answer that. Okay. I'm sure a colleague from the DOE can answer that more clearly than I can, but it does seem to me, if you look at the systemic tests in the system at grade 3, grade 6, etc., while there are huge efforts going on there and the results are improving, I'll be controversial here, if the National Senior Certificate was truly to reflect the results of all students, we would have failure rates that are simply unacceptable. I mean, if you take seriously the systemic testing where they're showing where students actually are. So, I mean, I think that perhaps what the Department of Education would also say is that there's a very, very high pass rate in English first additional language, which is something I've been quite involved with, a very, very high pass rate. But a lot of it is at a very low level. And I don't think as yet the National Senior Certificate in those core areas is actually tapping the kinds of things we're looking at enough. But can I come to that, because
I think we'll deal with that particular issue about whether in fact the matric results leads to a particular outcome. I know Mr. Shishi is looking very anxious there. Do you want to quickly say something, and then, because I don't want you to get a seizure in my committee. If
No, thank you, Jay. I just want to indicate that when you look at the matric results, and we're only speaking about only 20% that qualify for entry to university. If you were to say a system that produced that level of success doesn't have an extremely high failure rate, I don't know what high failure rate would mean. I think we should be intolerant about the levels of failure that are reflected in the matric examinations. I don't think we differ there. I think that the matric results provide a very accurate reflection of the performance of young people in this country. I think we can debate that another day, but I think it's important that we foreground this.
Okay.
I hear what you're saying, but we're going to debate that today, because we clearly, as members who are new to this portfolio, need to understand what this debate is about. Because it can't be, I mean, where I sit, and I'm not an expert in education, but it can't be that kids who are writing an exam paper, and I've seen some of these exam papers, and I must say to you that I don't think I quite understand some of the questions. But that's clearly because I've had an apartheid education. Okay, but it can't be that they are illiterate. I mean, it simply cannot be. Either it means that your matric exams are severely compromised, and you're going to talk to us about your security measures and so on, or it means that somebody has got something wrong. So we're going to have that discussion just now, and perhaps after, and maybe what we should do is to just go through your presentation rather, and then people jot down questions, because we then get diverted. But these are important questions that we'll need to have a conversation about just now, right?
Thanks, Chair. I must say that I have not seen the reports on which Professor Iloff based his comments, and nor would I actually couches in that language,
well,
as you'll see.
Can you just clarify for us whether it's one and the same test that he's basing
No, it's not. He's basing his comments on some language tests that have been written in historically Afrikaans universities. I haven't seen the reports, and I don't know what the claims are. But as you'll see, what we're saying is something a little bit different from that students can't read and write, not at all. Okay, so let me carry on, because I'll get to that very soon. So what these domains are...
Let me just finalize this issue of, and put to rest Professor Iloff's stuff, because I always thought that as chairperson of HESA, he was speaking to this report, but clearly he's speaking to another report. And it says here that, and this is, I'm quoting now from the business, they are not usually want to do that. But we were not at that meeting. We were in Pretoria with the department when that meeting occurred, so I have to rely on second-hand information. But he's said that most of South Africa's first-year university students could not read, write, or comprehend, nor could they spell. And he says further that universities conducted regular competency tests in English and Afrikaans reported a decline in standards. Now, clearly, what that's saying is and it's directed at the standards of education in our schools. And if this is saying something different, I think we need to say what's different about what this is saying and what the conclusions here are, as opposed, because then we tend to conflate things, and I think in all of the members' minds here it's almost like one and the same issue. So perhaps we needed to make that differentiation up front. Okay?
Thanks, Chair. So what these domains that we're testing in is actually AL, which is a shorthand for academic literacy. It's students' capacity to engage successfully with the demands of academic study in the medium of instruction. I just want to emphasize that, in fact, the Afrikaans versions of the National Benchmark Test are currently being piloted. So the report I'm talking about is only about English, in English proficiency across these institutions. QL is the orphan Annie of higher education, I think. It's our ability to manage and solve situations where we need to use numbers. And we know that, in fact, we are weak in that generally. We're always getting complaints from our graduates about that they can't actually deal with percentages or trends or this or that. So that's that domain. And then mathematics. This is students' manifestability related to mathematical concepts, formerly part of the National Senior Certificate Maths Curriculum Papers 1 and 2. From the perspective of what higher education thinks from papers 1 and 2 is important for progress in higher education study demanding mathematics. Now, you'll see in my next slide, this is the most critical one, because you can see here where we differ from the Professor Iloff's take on things. What the National Benchmark Test tries to do, in a nutshell, is to categorize students into one of these three bands per domain. So what higher education wants to know is, let's take academic literacy. You see the top band there, proficient. And it's saying, will the student's performance in academic literacy impede or not impede their studies? We're not saying pass or fail. We're saying, actually, if a student has problems here, in this domain, are they going to have problems in higher education? And if they get into proficient band, we're saying they're going to pass or fail because they love engineering or they broke up with their girlfriend or boyfriend. You know, there are all sorts of other factors that you can never predict success for. But we're saying it won't be because of academic literacy issues that they pass or fail. But in the intermediate band, we are saying that we have identified problems for those students who end up in the intermediate band. That will actually impact on their chances of getting a degree of quality within a reasonable time, and therefore that the universities have to do something about it. They have to put into place programs that address their needs. Near the top of intermediate, if a student getting near the top there, we're saying that the assistance might be quite small. Near the bottom, we're saying it actually would be quite extensive, so on an extended program, etc. And we know that only about a third of our students graduate in the minimum time anyway. But we're saying, deal with it responsibly. In the basic band, we are saying that in the domain, let's say people with academic literacy, such serious problems have been judged in the student's performance on the domain test, that an institution that admits students, we need to go on admitting those students because there are a lot of students in that domain. Those institutions have to be able to demonstrate to the Department of Education that they are doing something that will not result in a revolving door for those students. So that in a nutshell is what this program, we are not saying students can't read and write. We are saying that they exhibit challenges in a domain that institutions need to know about in advance and prepare to meet that. And that's not what's happening now. I can tell you in my data that I do have evidence of some institutions which have, and I'm not exempting UCT, which do have proportions of students in some of those categories which are not matched by the educational provision you can see the university offering. So this is a real wake-up call for higher education. But that is not the same thing as to say that students in the intermediate band can't read and write. Okay, that is it's a completely different thing. We are saying that there are challenges for them. Maybe they haven't actually been taught in the school system to use language to construct an argument in a way that is actually appropriate for first-level study. So we need to do something about that. And let me show you then, I will come off just to show you some of the data that we that has attracted some attention. And I don't think perhaps, Chair, that the committee is interested in the technical design features of the test, but I just want to say that, in fact, it's fundamentally different to how a norm reference test such as the National Senior Certificate, which, and remember, a norm reference test does have criterion referencing in it as well, but basically you're adjusting performance. In the National Benchmark Test, the NBTs, every item that's in those tests has been pre-tested. It has had bands of panelists from across the higher education sector looking at each item from the point of view of fairness, bias, content, construct. We have panels coming through. So each item has been looked at by four panels and piloted at least twice. Once that's done then, the tests are constructed on a blueprint of specifications and cognitive challenge levels. That means that every test is the same. So whether you write it in May, September, November, etc., it is an equated test. If you're interested in the technical design things, I can come back to them, but maybe we should just go on what the project is for the moment. What is very interesting for us about the NBT is that it can deliver information to us at an individual level and at a group level. At an individual level, institutions will be told what mark a student got, so let's say for math, they got 72%. And they'll also be told this puts them in the proficient category, and the proficient category is from 71% to 100%. I'm just making that up, okay? But it means that 72 is just into the proficient. So with institutions will know where they are in the band. And it's accompanied by a clear recommendation of what actually should happen to that student. That sounds terrible, but I mean, should that student actually ideally be in an extended program or what? But at a group level, and this is where I think the original design of the NBT is most interesting, it can tell the Faculty of Commerce at WITS or the Faculty of Engineering at KZN what the profile is of the entering cohort. So they can know that actually about 25% of their entering students are falling into the lower intermediate category, and therefore they should be providing an extensive system of extended programs or whatever the institution chooses as appropriate. So it's institutional autonomy. But they will know that beforehand. Now, lest you think, oh dear, but what if they just say, well, we're not going to take those students. That is not actually on the cards at all. Here, higher education is trying to expand. It's trying to expand. It cannot simply say, we are not going to take all the students we feel we're going to have to put extra effort into. And I mean, the whole history of higher education is a sad one of actually underperformance of the system as a whole and meeting its students' needs. So the group level, and I'll show you what that means as we come to some of the, okay, I've spoken about a bit of that. Are we operational now? So we can see we've had a whole research phase, we're now operational. And now to just talk to you about some of the data so you can see what use we can make of it. These were the participating institutions. I think you've actually got that in your packs. We try to get a bigger spread as possible while actually keeping the costs of things in control. University of Johannesburg also wrote, but unfortunately there were difficulties on that campus with invigilation and double bookings of venues. And so while we've responded to individual students, we couldn't actually include the data because the students had 2.5 hours, not 3 hours to write, and it would muddle it, things so. And a spread of institutions. I want to just emphasize that the standard setting process in an approach like this does not depend on the performance of the students in pilots. It's individual probability judgments of first year academics per item on the chances of success of students if they pass or cannot pass an item. Nevertheless, you want to know that the items themselves are statistically robust.
I'm not sure what you just
said. Okay. Oh, sorry. Okay. I'm just saying that while the sample is very important, the standards that were set were not dependent on the sample. Well, that's those cuts between basic and intermediate and proficient. Okay. Just the demographic variables I could get, you can see there that the proportions of black students in the pilot sample are the same as in higher education generally. Colored students slightly overrepresented, Indian students slightly underrepresented, white students, female and male breakdowns acceptable. And home language, I couldn't get that I couldn't find what the home language breakdown is in the system as a whole. I'm sure I must get it. And school background, there's still a dispute about how we actually categorize schools. So I couldn't do that. But anyway, we were satisfied when we looked at ourselves that it was represented. So this is what the press has picked on. And if I can just say, in parenthesis, Chair, that some of the kind of publicity that this project has generated, none of it has actually been of our kind of like putting out into the public domain at all. But in response to actually, I think the DOE will know, to the widespread sort of questions about OBE of a most peculiar kind. So we got drawn into that. That, I think, is where the muddle is, what Professor Iloff is saying. You can see there that a majority of students here, if you add the basic, the blue, and the red together, intermediate, and if you remember the judgments, intermediate needs support, basic needs really a lot of support. We are saying that, in fact, the majority of students entering higher education are in need of some support in the domain of academic literacy. We are not saying they can't read and write. We are saying they need some support. And why would that be a surprise? That should not be a surprise, and it is not a surprise. Most students are operating in their second, third, or fourth language, etc. It's always a big jump from school to university. But that is saying, and nobody has been surprised about that, but that's a very different thing from some sensational things about can't read and write. What we try, so to go back, to take that red bar, because if you remember, the intermediate is a very critical band for us, because we're saying at the top end, a little bit, at the bottom end, quite serious problems. So let's have a look. If we crack open that red band, you can see that there are more students who need only a little help and fewer students who need a lot of help. So there are real issues in academic literacy. Go to any university campus in the country and you will see their language development units and special language courses. This confirms that.
Can we just go back one slide? Professor has obviously put the blue and the red together, and rightly so. There's measures of support needed in them there, but I do indeed hope that the media are noticing that if you add the red and the blue together, by far the vast majority of our students with some support should be able to succeed at university. I mean, that would be a reading of that graph. In fact, only 851 of the 12,000 odd, in fact, were deemed to be at a basic level, needing those intensive levels of support. So really, as I say, the interpretation, I think, is very critical about this. Thanks, Jen.
Yep, I agree completely.
Just in case the media also can't read and write.
No, it's more, what's more of a problem is quantitative literacy.
Okay, let me just show you quantitative literacy.
But let me just show you the academic literacy by faculty. This is of all the samples that were there, so, you know, all the institutions that participated. If you break it down, you can see, look at commerce. It's just interesting. I mean, commerce has the highest proportion of students who actually are proficient. Education is very small there because WITS, I think, was the only institution that had undergraduate education. Okay, so, but you can see there are engineering. The more selective disciplines you can see it really confirms much of what we know there.
That's a bit of a misnomer, because even with the law faculty, for example, as much as I would agree that lawyers are the stupidest bunch, being a lawyer myself, sorry. There were only two universities or three universities who actually
gave undergraduate law.
That's right. Yeah. So in that sense, there's a distortion, isn't that so?
Yeah, absolutely. These are really for illustrative purposes. And then that's just cracking open the top and bottom. And again, there you can see that in fact there's more in the top of the intermediate than in the bottom of the intermediate. Okay. But quantitative literacy shows a real problem now. This is a new focus in higher education. It's a new focus in the schools, mathematical literacy, et cetera, et cetera. So we would expect really problematic levels of performance. And I must say...
This is the one that you're saying about graphs and so forth.
Yes, that's right,
so
you know.
It's not reading and so on.
Well, it's really numbers in text as well, so they're related. And the students write them as one test, but we report them as two, you know, so we separate the things. I mean, this is really, you know, about if you say 8 out of 100 people can do this, how many people out of 500 can do it? And et cetera. And it's, here we have very different results from the Maths Literacy NSC, of course, but we'll converge, I think, eventually. And here you'll see if I go down to splitting the intermediate, you can see most of the problem is in the weaker half. All right, and you can see across the faculties real problems. Even look at, it's quite interesting, you look at engineering there. Look at the high proportion in basic and in intermediate. So, I mean, we really welcome, this is just illustrative because it's interesting. In the engineering, those students would have done mathematics, not mathematical literacy. And shows what different subjects they are, because these are really highly selected students who can't actually do quantitative literacy. So there's a whole lot of interesting stuff here to work with the DOE on about what these two domains of maths and maths literacy sort of are saying. And there it's by faculty as well, and you'll see there are problems. And now we come to maths. Now, this is what is actually really... alarmed people. You can see there of this sample very, very low numbers who fell into the proficient band. Now, the National Benchmark Test is a new project, and we have said right up front that it may well be that in respect particularly of mathematics, the benchmark between the red and the green may be a set a little bit too far to the right. So what we are looking at is cracking open the red thing and saying, if we did get it wrong and it's a little bit too far to the right, what would it look like if we moved it a bit to the left? So we cracked the intermediate band, and there you can see it changes it, but says the big problem is on the lower intermediate and the basic, where it's very unlikely that a mistake of that magnitude was made. We can talk a bit later about what the universities are experiencing now. I've papers about the numbers. Let me say it right now while I'm here. A paper that's just come out of the... I apologize for using my own institution, but it's where I am, so I can get the data. Whereas in 2005, 106 students who had written matric the previous year were passing, that is getting 50% or more. So 106 students in 2005. In 2009, in other words, this year, only 81 students got 50% or more, and there were tracking done on whether the courses were comparable, et cetera, et cetera. So there is an issue at the very top end, and that's been recognized, et cetera. But what I must say, what this paper concludes is not that the NSC because they've been looking at a steady downward trend in passes at the university. So they're saying it's not the NSC, it's declining levels of preparation for university mathematics over the last few years. But we can come to that. Then mathematics by faculty. You can see there across the system, and interestingly, engineering and commerce, obviously, but science, you can see science, and I don't think science faculties around the country have really actually grasped the issue of maths in many ways, but there it's reflected. And there you can see it's cracked again. Just to remind you where we set the mathematics standards, on anything that's in papers 1 and 2, plus what the higher education sector thinks this means in terms of preparedness for first year study, but based on that curriculum. And that's where we need to talk as the two sectors. Some interpretations of the results are obviously the national senior certificate is set at too low a level. That is a possible interpretation. The second one is that we've set an NBT, the bar, unrealistically high. That's an interpretation. And the third one, and the one that I can't kind of get my head around because I don't know, is whether the papers 1 and 2 are being taught in their entirety at schools or whether bits are being taught and examined. So that's something we simply don't know. And this, I don't think we're going to go into that too much, but it is showing, in fact, that I don't have a pointer, unfortunately, but if you look along, if you moved your hand like this along that graph, cursor. You see where along the bottom bar, where it says NEC maths percentage, and then along the top, there it says NBT maths. If you moved your hand upright like this vertical, till you got to 70% on the bottom bar, okay, and you just moved it up like that, you'd see all those students, those dots to the right, all those students got 70% or more in the National Senior Certificate Maths. But if you overlaid our basic, intermediate, and proficient, you can see where we're placing students there. And one of the conclusions of this very interesting and very thorough paper actually is that universities would not actually be very much helped by simply moving up their admissions points because there's too much scatter even at the highest points. And I know the DOE is going to do something about that this year in the exam, which might help greatly. So, Chair, just to sort of conclude, the NBT is about higher education trying to get a handle in important core domains on what it has to do to meet the needs of students. If we show very big different pictures from what the DOE shows, that does not mean that either us or they are wrong, but that we are looking at different things. I mean, the gap shouldn't be as wide, and we would hope to work together, and that and it might well be that in a few years we don't need the NBT, except maybe cyclically, every 5 years or something, just as a sort of check on the curriculum innovations. But now it's really up to higher education to say, okay, well, we've got X number of our students in basic, what are we going to do about it? And I know the last Minister of Education said to me, jokingly once, she said, we are waiting to see how many students are in the intermediate band so that we can properly resource the foundation program. Because the DOE has recognized, actually, the legacy of a very diverse educational system and the challenge that is for higher education.
Let's just, before we get questions of clarity on your input, because I think that's a very interesting finding, because what that says, and it's good that you clarified that the tests, the NBT tests, incorporate your paper 1 and paper 2, which is your matric paper 1 and paper 2, but it also, and you say, it also tests for proficiency at a level that is acceptable at university level. Now, clearly what that shows is that while more students pass the NSC maths, they don't necessarily do so well when it comes to the additional requirements in terms of your NBT, which is
this loosely worded thing called what we require at universities, so the additional part of it. Is that a fair interpretation of what this is?
Well, there's nothing additional in what we're asking that's not in papers 1 and 2.
Well, then why are you testing if there's not something additional?
Well, we're getting very different results there, and then because students have got very high failure rates once they, even when they have high marks in
that. So you actually then, by implication, questioning whether in fact either you're saying that the standard of the maths paper is not sufficiently high, or you're saying that if it is sufficiently high, you're not quite sure that these people should be passing it.
No, Chair, it's a more sort of confusing picture than that, because it is possible for somebody in a curriculum-based exam like that to swap and get good marks without actually being able to apply that. Now, the new OBE is trying to do something about that. So, I mean, you know, we all welcome that. But the students who are getting 80% and above there, it's very little sort of a knowledge we can have about whether they're going to pass or fail. We are testing some different things. We're testing things that are fair because they're in paper 1 and paper 2. But the questions are, are papers 1 and paper 2 actually being taught? Because we're choosing anything in papers 1 and paper 2 to test, and I'm not sure that that's what's happening in the NSC. I simply don't know, so I'd be most interested.
Well, look, I mean, that's one of your findings, that possibly the whole curriculum is not sufficiently being taught at school. But, you see, that's why I wanted to focus on this math thing, because I can understand.
When we talk about languages and literacy and all of that stuff, because clearly a lot of the subjects at school, you can SWOT.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, maths, you can't SWOT and pass. You simply cannot SWOT maths and pass. I mean, I've done maths at matric, and I was in an apartheid school, apartheid education school, and an apartheid standard school. And I know, as much as I'm not an education expert, that you cannot SWOT maths and pass at that level. Unless there are serious challenges with the security of the maths exam, in which case you can SWAT.
Yeah, you
can have schools that coach people for exams, and although the NSC was new, nevertheless, it couldn't diverge too much, etc. And there are students go from they go to get coached. You can have teachers who actually set up and they coach. You can have people who actually like look at the exemplars and actually drill them. That's not against the exemplars, but maths is not exempt from that. And in fact, in some ways, it's more vulnerable. Because what you hear from maths 1 courses all over the show, students actually have the knowledge, but they don't actually apply it, and that's why OBE came on. But maths is not some rarefied, separate kind of domain of knowledge that can't be rote learned. Although that's strange to those of us who are mathematically challenged. It's just not what the evidence really shows.
But the point of the matter is that there is a serious discrepancy. If we're testing the same kind of outcomes, because I imagine that the whole point of OBE, and I'm told that we're now for the first time having a maths exam that is OBE compliant, so to speak, which is all about application and so on, and you're saying you're testing for application, clearly there's a big discrepancy. Now, one of the possibilities, of course, that we haven't, and perhaps you also haven't looked at, is the consequences of this exam as opposed to the matric exam. So this is what I'm saying. For the student, failing a matric exam has huge consequences. So what do? You study a lot. You put in a lot of effort. What are the consequences, really, in real terms, for a student not passing these exams? You're just going to get more support, right? The consequence isn't that you're going to get kicked out of university.
Sure, the consequences go that you'll be placed in an extended program, which looks to students as though it's lengthening their period of study. In fact, it's often not, because they're going to take longer anyway. You can also not be selected, because if a university has 500 people who've got 70% for maths, and they look at the second order indicator, the NBTs, that will tell. I mean, that's been going on for years. I mean, the NBTs are simply replacing a whole lot of sets of entrance exams that the universities have used.
So that's seriously problematic. Because for me,
legally, you're entitled to be at university if you've passed your matric exam at a specific level.
The statutory requirements that there's a minimum requirement to NSC, and universities have the right to set additional requirements.
And so this becomes gatekeeping.
This is actually meant to be a more benign form. There have been tests in this area for many years. This is designed for placement, but to say that in fact it doesn't have consequences and so students won't take it seriously, I don't think of that.
So the consequence is that if I apply for engineering, mm-hmm. I would have to write the test first, mm-hmm. and then only will I be chosen or not, arising from my results.
It depends on what the institution has decided. Institutions have autonomy on that.
So but which institutions would I face those consequences, and which ones would I not?
I can't tell you at this stage, but I think, Chair, that in fact we are required to do something about the needs of our students. And if we have, I'm trying to see what it is, 451 students who actually have got over 70 or 80% on the NSC, and of those, 81 pass, how responsible are we being just to admit them on the basis of NSC? I mean,
But they would have passed their matric exam. If we look at the maths, it's just look at maths, right? And say that we're talking about the engineering faculty or the science faculty, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you see there's this huge discrepancy. What would you say is the extent of the fairness of that assessment based on, firstly, the degree of preparedness, which is much higher in terms of the matric, I would imagine, and secondly, in terms of these scarce skills and so on that we keep on complaining about, you know, we're not sort of putting our students sufficiently and so on. While I get your point that it would be unfair for us to merely say, well, okay, you don't know maths, and so therefore your chances of succeeding in a particular domain is virtually none, so therefore it's not fair for us to admit you. But if you have a student who has performed fairly well at matric and fairly dismally in your entrance exam, so to speak, where do you then draw that line, number one? Number two, really and truly, if this test was aimed at getting universities to support students, then surely it should not be used as a gatekeeping exercise. It should be saying to the engineering faculty at the university X, Y, or Z that, hello, you need to institutionalize your support mechanism, not turning people away necessarily based on poor performance, because I do think that cognizance should be then taken of the matric results as well.
I agree completely. You've just said what I've not said so well.
But is that what is happening?
Yes, that's exactly what's happening. We're trying to identify which students need support and make sure that the university is provided. That was why the NBT was started. Mm-hmm. So remember our throughput and our pass rates are extremely low. We're trying to do something about that.
My worry was what you said earlier, was that, you know, if in some institutions students get turned away simply because they perform badly in these exams while having done well at your matric level. But let me hear, Ms. Binford. I see you wanted to say something.
I just do think that this, you've hit on the right ground. This is where the DOE would like to concentrate, because there's huge variation. But also to say, let's look at the fact that it's all moving in the right direction. You know, if you look at the kids who got above 80% in the matric, the majority of them at the intermediate or proficient stage, so there's some levels here. I think that your question to Professor Yeld was correct, but she didn't take up the issue of its importance. Now, when you listen to Professor Delaray and how university students are behaving in their first month, February, when this test is happening. I'm not sure that students are saying this is something really important. Remember, they have not been academically engaged for 4 months. They last wrote exams. And I think we've got some really interesting stuff here about, is it this, at the school level? Here you've got, I mean, I can't imagine what this young person who got 95% was doing the night before he wrote the MBBT exam to be landing up here. But look at that big bunch at the top there. And so I think we want to trace these students, whether it's the, at the school level, what was happening to them, and find out whether the MBT could not be administered now in July or August to see what's happening when people are now more committed and understand the importance of this. But Chair, I want to ask Professor Yeld whether this is going to be used in September and October as part of the entrance requirements for future at any university, because that's the issue that you're raising. If you want to use this support, when the start being administered in September or October 2009, you have to question how it's going to be used. In a first year, when there's no determination of the predictability of success of these students in their first and second year. This was February.
Yes, it is being written. It's been written from May, the next one September, October, November, and as far as I know, certainly GCT has been used in the faculties of engineering, etc., as a second order indicator, because the NSC is equally unpiloted in terms of its predictive validity. So the MBT is actually, I think, more rigorously designed, but we could go into arguments about that.
Yeah.
Let's then get the questions on clarity on the inputs as a whole from members first.
Thank you, Chairperson. I think I'd like to concentrate on the interpretations of the results. And there are three very important interpretations. One points to the higher education, one points to the basic education, but the last one is the one that I would like to put a question to our department. What are you saying about that statement? That there are, or the implication of that statement says that there are coaching happening at your schools, or our schools for that matter. What are you saying about that? Because, let me also say this and be... I seek for your tolerance. I've been a math teacher for 15 years. I never received any 100% results each year. Armin Hendricks was my subject advisor. He was not happy with me. I said, I'm happy because my students went out to university. They came back to say thank you because I passed math. And wherever I'm working, the math that you taught me helps me a lot. So, whilst we may have results of 100% and the passes are there, then the department must seriously look at whether there is not too much coaching of question papers happening in our schools. What are the departments saying about that? Thank you.
Can I try and respond? I'll respond also as a math teacher. Thank you. And let me say firstly, you know, any subject, but probably maths is a good example, in the assessment of the competencies around that subject, any exam paper will inevitably have a section in it that is largely going to be possible for most students to complete successfully. So, you know, there's a section there that if you're an average student, you're likely to be okay. You'll get maybe your 40-50% sort of thing. There will clearly be questions in that exam paper that are pushing a little bit further, so we start distinguishing between the average and now the better students, and maybe, you know, those who are looking at 70% or something would you know, be able to crack those questions. And then, of course, there are always some questions which are really going to be the real extension questions that really extract the top students out of that pool and really identify them and help them. So I think it's inevitable that any assessment would be of that nature. And I'm a little bit worried about this notion that there's perhaps too much coaching going on. Now, I'm not sure what the understanding is about coaching, but in the end, teaching is about preparing your learners to write and pass an exam. And I'm not sure that preparing learners to be able to complete that exam successfully is really a bad thing. I think for us, perhaps a little bit more of that should be going on, because that's really what we're looking for. We want teachers to teach the full curriculum, to prepare students in the right way, etc. So I think we must be a little bit cautious about this notion that, that people are coaching and that somehow that's wrong. Are students supposed to find their own way there? I'm not sure. So that's a little concern. That I would say, chair on that one. So yeah, I don't think it's something that we should now start identifying and saying, no, we don't want people to teach to the exam. I think in our context, really, this is probably something we should be encouraging rather than discouraging. There are other comments, but that's just a response on that one. Am I right?
Yes.
Thanks. Just around that discussion with the discrepancies between the different testing, are there any studies that have been done in other countries that would compare? Because obviously other countries, the universities must have some form of entrance exam, and do the tendencies compare in any way, and is there anything that we've been able to extract sort of in that area? And then also just, yeah, I was also concerned about that coaching situation, because obviously no matter how much you coach somebody, they can only, they have to have some form of understanding in order to apply it to some other question. So I can't see a problem with the coaching, so I'm not quite getting that argument, unless I'm missing something. But yeah, thanks.
Can I
make
a broader,
comment?
Can I make a broader comment before you come in?
Yeah, I think we'd probably like to respond, but I would want to pick up first on that last graph, and just I think to reiterate what Ms. Winterfeld said, that while obviously there's a high degree of scatter that graph at the end, and as you say, it's something we're trying to address. just a very nice one, yeah. Yeah, clearly that's an issue we need to address as to why there should be such a wide discrepancy. But I think, as Benny has said, largely, in a sense, we firstly tracked the graph in terms of direction, but you will see that the trend line, I think, if you put it through our results, would be remarkably similar to the MBT. So let me just comment on that. And perhaps in the light of that, Chair, let me say that we really do welcome the presentation, the work that has been done, and to reiterate what we have said, that the department certainly has no problems with genuine research where this is done, and I think what we've seen today is indeed an example of that. But let me also say that what we have heard today is rather different from what we have seen and read over the past week or so, and I think it's very different to what we've expected. Part of the reason why I've got two DDGs, my head of exams and myself here, is we thought we were coming here to mount a very vigorous defense. Well, at the moment, there's not a huge amount, I think, that we'd want to. Even Mr. Fishy tells me he's very calm at the moment, Madam Chair. So if he's calm, then we're calm.
If he's calm, I don't want to see him excited.
Okay, you'll see him in a moment, Chair. All right. But yeah, perhaps that is a little reminder for us, as I say, what's been out in the public domain, I think, has been very damaging to many people. And it's not about our own protection as departmental officials. We live with this on a daily basis. My concern is that there's been a large number of youth who effectively have been told that even though you've got 90% in matric, actually you can't read, write, or comprehend. And really that's very damaging. And I would hope, Chair, that all of us just recognize the potential danger that does pose, and not something that we need to do. Madam Chair, our response is largely summed up, and I hope some at least saw it in the Cape Times yesterday, a full response article, but it starts off with that notion of not condemning our children. I think we do need to recognize that kind of thing, but a lot of the comments we might have made are in there, so I'm not going to go through them again. But just to summarize in 3 points, I suppose. Firstly, we as the department have acknowledged very serious performance and quality issues. We know that. There's no defense around that. We do indicate some of the questions about the methodology, etc., and perhaps we'd like to engage further around that. But perhaps most importantly, it also spells out in our response what we are doing about it, and certainly to recognize it's not something that we're just living with. Madam Chair, honourable members, we are engaged in an ongoing conversation with HESA. So this chair is not by any means a unique experience. I'm sorry the chair if he's arisen here, because I think that would have been an important part of the conversation. But to say this isn't just a casual conversation either, it's a highly structured engagement. Ironically, it's highly structured, particularly around issues of curriculum and assessment. HESA have been very strongly involved in our curriculum development process. They have been very active participants in fact, devising the curriculum and the assessment standards within that, so a very big involvement they've had there. But likewise, their involvement in the examination process itself is enormous. There are a significant number of external moderators who are, in fact, higher education academics, etc. So, you know, from that side, they are certainly, in many senses, setting the standards of our National Senior Certificate. And, of course, HESA formally is involved in the standardization of results. Now, I think...
If that is the case, why the need then for further assessments on things like maths? Because you see, for me, if I could understand this, if there was not that kind of collaboration, if there was a complete arm's length situation, our universities were developing separately and so on and so on. And particularly if we're talking about this kind of entrance requirement, I'm not even talking about the support thing, which is, I think, an entirely laudable thing and so on. But the gatekeeping issue worries me a great deal. Because if we're saying that your maths exam at your matric level is sufficiently high, of a sufficiently high standard, then what is it that prevents or that motivates a university to say, no, for entrance into our university, over and above your matric, we want to test to see whether you are really proficient in that. That's assuming what you're saying is correct, that it is higher education that has in any case been involved in the curriculum development at schools, at matric level, their moderators, etc., etc., etc.
Professor Yale provided perhaps a partial explanation for that. She indicated a concern at the beginning of the presentation about what she described as grade inflation in matric. I'm a little bit curious about that, and I suppose in two results. One, of course, is that this is the first National Senior Certificate, so you know, relative to what, I'm not sure. But of course, perhaps more importantly, since 2004, in fact, our matric overall pass rate has either been standard or declining. So, you know, this was going to be done. This probably should have been done in 94, 95 or so, when we did see that spike, certainly, and we acknowledged that. But since then, in fact, we've had very stable or, in fact, declining grades. So, you know, that itself, I think, would be there. Madam Chair, look, certainly we can talk about the kind of international benchmarking that is done around these, and I think Mr. Tishy would do that. That's right.
Wants to come in on that issue. Given that in fact there is no inflation, or what is the word?
Grade inflation.
In fact, by all
accounts. In fact, we're in a recession. Grade recession.
What then so motivates that kind of attitude around entrance? Because I'm still very curious about it.
Complicated things. I mean, what the DG was talking about was huge grade inflation in the number of passes under Minister Asma. And under Minister Pandor, a retraction, you're quite correct, but not perhaps to realistic levels again. Over the years of the testing done by the Alternative Admissions Research Project, another national project, etc., looking into TAP potential, we have seen declining levels of performance in the domain areas. That actually do not match the results that have been coming out of the senior certificate. And it's for that reason that the NSC and the OBL greatly welcomed. But in this situation of huge curriculum innovation in schools and a totally new qualification, higher education thought it was very important to develop some lens through which they could learn to interpret the results of the National Senior Certificate. And I think that that's a responsible thing to do. And I mean, I think that the DOE has acknowledged in various fora that in the mathematics paper particularly, they got it wrong. So for various reasons, so the DOE and Imalusi between them, that there were too few really challenging questions at the top end. And there were too many students pumped out with very high results. So So I know that things are going to be done about that, etc. But I mean, it did dent confidence a bit, particularly in the public announcements right near the beginning, that in fact this definitely did reflect performance. So we're all in the situation of learning the new thing, but to think that higher education somehow shouldn't have acted responsibly to try to find out what the needs of the students are. So.
That's not what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that I would agree 102%. And I say 102 because clearly I'm illiterate in math. but that if it is an act of responsibility, in other words, that our students need additional support and we need to provide that support, then that's one thing. And that I don't think you'll find anybody around the table here saying, we will not support that kind of initiative. But if it is gatekeeping, then I have a serious problem with it. And I saw Mr. Shishi moving around in his chair when he was speaking about getting it wrong in the maths paper. Do you agree?
I fully agree with you, but I'm not sure.
Chair, I think I'm relieved that there is clarity that has been provided by Prof. Yield, that there is difference between the report that was conducted by Professor Filov, and that she disagrees with that report. She disagrees that the standard of our exiting students to university is to the level that is as alarming as Prof. Filov has indicated. And I think that distinction to me is crucial. And I hope that the reporting of these two must clarify this, so that there's no confusion to the public that this is the focus. I can live with the debate on gatekeeping or not, because with the exams anywhere in the world engage in this kind of debate. We can't be an exception. We have to unfortunately have to say that when we speak of the South African national exam system, people need to know that this is not an exam system that has been established overnight. The South African examination system is more than 150 years old. We have got traditions that come from many years of benchmarking tools that we use. We've got benchmarking tests. We've got research nationally and internationally. We've got internal.
Why don't you go into your presentation and answer this question about whether, in fact, you've got it wrong? Was the maths paper, for example, far too easy over a period of time? Has that been corrected and so on? And then maybe you can then go into all of these things that inform the matric exam, and you can give us a sense of internationally what is the standard of our matric exam compared to other countries. Maybe you want to do that in your presentation quickly and go straight into it.
I would like to do that if time allows, but I think it's very important for us to indicate that what we were concerned about has already been addressed. I don't think that I'm as concerned as I was earlier about this as now. I think the clarity has been provided. The purpose of my presentation would be to argue that, hey, we've got a world-class national examination system.
Well, show us what you've done.
Okay.
Can we talk about the
maths? Yeah,
while Mr. Shishi is setting up, you can just speak specifically about that question.
So when the results came out, the difficulty for us, and this is where we would ask HESA and higher education, especially the engineering faculty that are commenting now, when the papers were written in very early November, and we gave papers to higher education institutions, nobody commented on the quality there. These remarks were not adjusted substantially in any way. But what happened is that in the past there were about 8,000 A's and about 8,000 B's. This went up to in the order of 25,000, got A and B. So clearly it's close to doubling the numbers that were there. And that's when former Minister Pandor asked for an investigation. Now, the only way you can do this, and this is what we would like to do with the benchmark testing as well, how many items are the same? Are academics asking them in slightly different ways to the way the kids are? And this is trouble with a test like this. It's the way you set it can throw kids, but leave that aside. What we did was we then took item by item and we looked at the paper. Those higher education faculty pronounced that if you got 50% on the maths paper in 2009, you would have got higher grade in the past. So that's an important thing for us to remember. But at the top end, in fact above 65%, there wasn't enough differentiation to help higher education, especially the engineering faculties, understand who was competent. In that way, the benchmark testing has reflected that. But I think that it's we would find it more responsible if we are talking about higher education, then uses that word, being responsible. I would have expected that rather than going to the press, making public statements about the national benchmark test, as I sit here today, I have had no feedback saying it's this particular concept that you need to improve, that you need to make sure that you're testing it and so on. And if higher education wants to be responsible, they need to give us feedback on the benchmark testing to say, per item, and whether it's the A, B, and C kids, does paper 3 help in the engineering faculty? So that's what we would look from higher education going forward over the next 3 years so that we can improve the curriculum and our teaching.
I think that's quite an important issue and something that hopefully we'll conclude with as well. Is the reiteration that clearly the benchmark testing and what happens at your matric level, there needs to be close synergies over time evolving out of this process so that there is actually one test for both entrance, for qualification, statutory or otherwise, and support for that matter. Because clearly it seems to me that if I've got 50% in my matric exam, even all things being equal, and I am wanting to do an engineering degree or something of that sort, one would expect that there would be gaps. I mean, that makes absolute sense to me. But Mr. Sishi, you're going to now talk to us about the matric exam thing. But I just, before we get over Professor Yell's input, the one question that I did want to seek clarity on, Professor Yell, is when those exams are written, it's a three-hour paper, all of that you've explained now, that's fine, and I don't need the detail of it. But what I would like to, because it won't make any sense to me anyway, it makes sense to Ms. Linford and these people here. But what I do want to know is, what is the percentage that separates your basic, intermediate, and proficient? So in other words, if I got 50, would I be intermediate? Would I be basic? So where would those percentages lie, and how would that separate the students, number one? Number two, given that the primary aim of these tests is to ensure that universities provide bridging support, and given the question that Ms. Dudley asked about international experience, I mean, I always assumed that we were a bit of an awkward country in our education system simply because we have the unusual practice of having kids who have finished matric go to university as a first stage. Whereas in many other countries, you have bridging, finishing courses, you have colleges, and then only university, which then takes away the problem of bridging. And that's something that we haven't really discussed too much. But what then have the universities sought to import by way of learning from experiences in other countries? What kinds of support have been initiated in our universities? You did allude to the fact that they are disparate in nature and so on. And are you in discussions about making uniform this kind of support? Because it seems to me that if they are disparate at different institutions, you're going to get different outcomes in any case. when you're talking about Tarakut, which is really the area that you guys are worried about very centrally and seriously. So those three issues.
Wow, a complicated set of issues. First thing, the standing setting process is, if you can remember those three layers, there'll be a cut score between basic and intermediate, and another cut score between intermediate and proficient. They're different in each domain. And the cut scores don't derive from a meaning like 50% or something. How they were derived were by large groups of first-year academics teaching first-year students, making probability judgments on the basis of each item about how important it was for a student to pass or fail that item. And that aggregates then into a percentage. I haven't got them in my head. They're not nice, easy ones like 30 or 40 or 50%. But for each domain, quantitative literacy would have X and Y. And those are set for 3 years. They're totally independent of the student's writing. They're probability judgments of the experts. They're used internationally as a way of setting benchmarks. And it doesn't matter with this kind of testing whether everybody becomes proficient. I mean, that's we would all love to have. It's not a norm reference thing at all. So I don't know if I've made any sense to you whatsoever, except to say that those cut scores aren't dependent on the class writing them, if you see what I mean. They are judged by academics from every single institution in this country represented on what a first-year successful student needs to be able to do.
Yeah, but I mean, all I'm asking is this. You've got a test. I write the test. If I get 50% on my test, where would I be?
Well, it depends what domain you've got. If you've got 50% for academic literacy, I can't remember the thing, but mm-hmm. you would if the domain boundaries are for intermediate were 40 to 60, let's say, you would be in the intermediate. I can't remember where exactly the boundaries are. I could look it up in my system, but...
But, I mean, would there be definite boundaries?
Yes. They are cut scores.
And that would be different for your MANTS, for your quantitative literacy and your literacy.
Yes, absolutely. There is a score at that line and a score at that line. A percentage.
So technically what you're saying in theory, in your maths exam, if you got 60%, you could be at basic.
theoretically, yeah. If that's where the benchmark was set. But that would be a strange test. I mean, but theoretically it's possible. Okay. Okay.
So, I mean, because it's very specific to the requirements of the university.
That's correct.
And so on.
Okay. For students taking first year maths, where is the benchmark? And it's actually a fascinating process.
It's a very subjective thing as well, isn't it?
Certainly it is. But I mean, you know, what you do is you get big enough panels that are representative, and each item is looked at again and again, etc. And so it's not like random.
No, I'm not suggesting for a minute that it's random, but it is very subjective.
It's true. You know, what gets you 75% is often quite subjective too. In a university, what gets you a first class pass, you can get three people to mark, and but you try to provide the training and the all assessments.
Yes, I must say to you, it's fascinating me more and more. Whenever I ask a question, I think I'm going to get a grey or pink answer. I get like a purple answer.
Okay, come and work with us. With the reference to international experience, entrance tests, if I can call it, you know, we're trying not to develop entrance tests, we're trying to develop placement tests, okay, so they're slightly different. But in the UK, with the huge grade inflation in the A-levels, etc., that has also been the case. In America, which actually sets very little store by school leaving exams in some ways, has the SAT, which has had a very peculiar influence. So it's not confined to South Africa. What we're trying to do with it is slightly different, because we're trying to hold higher education to account through this.
My question was really about the discrepancies. Are you seeing them there, and do they correlate in any way? Are they telling the same story?
Universities, do they also exist discrepancies in terms of the gaps that need to be filled?
Yes, certainly, because usually they're not set in exactly the same domain areas. They're looking at the kinds of things that are likely to actually impact on success in higher education rather than what the school syllabus covers in biology. And the third thing, the very complicated question about academic development and the kind of support necessary, I think that really internationally we are in the forefront of the kinds of innovations that institutions have tried to do to meet the needs of students, unevenly over the sector, and in some ways slightly superficially. But I think that we have really tried in South Africa that access shouldn't be limited to certain groups and certain preparedness, and I would be very dismayed if that actually became the case. I think that the moves that the Council on Higher Education on the four-year curriculum are very hopeful, because I think it's going to be a long time before a 12-year school system can prepare us for a three-year degree system. That is simply internationally not known. In the UK, you do 13 years, and then you have a three-year system. In the States, you do 12 years, 13 if you add reception, and you have a four-year degree. We're trying to do 12 years and 3 years. It's simply not fair on the school system, and it's not fair. So we look forward to the four-year curriculum as space to develop responses. I don't know if that answers the three, but they were big questions.
No. Thank you, Chair, for the opportunity. I would advise Prof. Yale that at a point when implementation for the test must take place, I think they need to really consider piloting to a very restricted number of universities that have been trained how to administer the tool, and universities that uphold the values that need to underpin any project of this nature, a project that seeks to improve standards. And I think also it's very important to indicate before I go on that as a department and speaking with DG, having already spoken on this matter, I think that we are relieved that the values underpinning this testing project do not differ to the values that we as a department uphold, values of quality and high standards. These are the values that we uphold. It's not so urgent for me to make emphasis that I had prepared to make this morning, because I don't think that matric exams are under attack unfairly. I think that the parents out there, and all of us are, should feel relatively calm that we are saying today that the matric exams in South Africa are of a high standard, that the sky's the limit. We still have a long way to go to make sure that in the ways we prepare young people for the matric exams, we prepare them in such a manner that they are able to derive from the preparation the necessary skills that are articulated in our curriculum that would enable them to participate in any benchmarking test anywhere in the world, not necessarily through the test that we are talking about, and succeed. We do not, as I stand here, have a problem of parents reporting that if they take their young people to universities outside of the country, they do not. They have a problem of entry in any international universities. We do not have that problem in history and even now. And therefore, I think those are very important factors. For the sake of those who might not be familiar with the core of the national examination system. When we speak of the national examination, those are components that are reflected there of the system. These are key components. When we say we are prepared, when we are saying towards the end of this year we are ready for another quality examination, we are saying that those are the areas that we have prepared the system with, and we are sure that our universities are going to receive again a group or a cohort of young people that are properly prepared. But the examination as a tool for assessment does not have a responsibility for preparing learners. Its responsibility is accuracy, its fairness, its integrity, its credibility. And these are the principles that we would like to argue when we say our examination is our world class. We're not talking about performance. You can perform at a high level or at a very low level, but if the tools that we administer are the tools that are considered to be internationally comparable, are the tools that are fair in terms of the methodology that is used. And I would like to ask the same questions to Prof. Yeld about those kinds of basic questions in assessment, principles of good assessment. And if that is what we understand, that's very important. Secondly, the examinations in South Africa are not just prepared by the officials of the Department of Education. This is a system effort. That is why once exams are prepared, once they are set, they are moderated externally. That is a very, very important factor. DG has indicated that the moderation of our exam is done by almost more than 70% of officials that are directly appointed from universities themselves, which means that that's the role of HESA within our examinations. Almost all our external examiners that are appointed, mostly by UMALUSI, the external quality assurance body, are directly appointed from the universities.
They also set papers.
No, the department officials administer the process, but they don't set.
Who set?
Who set? We advertise for this, and the best people, and the criteria is known publicly. We contract them for about 3 years. The majority of them are people who are subject advisors, which means that they are people of experience in the field at which they practice. We guarantee that there is nobody who can be an examiner who hasn't at least a degree in the area that they are appointed to set. And in the majority of cases, we've got people with multiple qualifications in their areas. And this is open. It's in our website. This, including all the tools I'm talking about, all the question papers. Unfortunately, NAN's tools are not yet accessible publicly, but well, because I don't have the test right now, I don't. Yeah, well, they are secure. Ours are in the website. You can go to them now as I speak to you. You can take a math paper. If I argue that our math papers are of a particular standard, you can go to the website now and download the paper. And I can tell you that if you graduated, those of us who had math teachers will not be able to write those papers.
Can I clarify? That's not the 2009 math paper, yeah? But that's the issue also to indicate it's not a single examiner that sets the paper. It's, in fact, a panel of at least three people who set the paper.
I think it's important that when we speak about exam results and the quality and the performance of learners, we look at the foundations in terms of the components. For example, when we speak about site-based assessment, there's another discourse that must occur around this. When you speak about external exams, there is another discourse that must be there. But overall, as we take accountability for the administration of the tool, it is important. It is important for us to then say that we take the issue of standards very seriously. I would like to share with you this morning, because the presentation covered quite a big ground. I would like to share with you some of the studies that we ourselves have conducted in ensuring that the exam results are of quality. These are the international benchmarking tests that we conduct that include examination bodies around the world, and they would be your British examination councils, about three of them, some in Africa, some in Australia. More than five in international examinations were involved, for example, in the last two examinations that we've conducted. And they benchmark our questions. And once these benchmark reports have been prepared, they are used by our own panels and ourselves in the training of the very same panel in addressing whatever concerns are there. So when we're saying that our examinations are comparable to international standards, we are deriving this from reports and tests that have been conducted internally. We are observed in our standardization processes by international peers. We when we standardize examinations, we compare the standard of 2000 X examination with at least the five previous examinations that would have been conducted so that we do not have a fluctuation of standards. This year we have this standard in terms of exams. The following year the standard is likely higher or up depending on who you employ as your examiners or your moderators. What we do is we engage in a process of standardization that ensures equivalence of standards or comparability of standards in all exams that have been conducted so that you don't have all of a sudden this shift. I think that higher education can actually attest to the fact that between the previous exams that we've conducted and the first national senior certificate exam that we've conducted, there is no drastic shift in terms of trends in whether you are analyzing per subject or in whatever domain that you are interested in. There is no drastic shift in terms of the results that you are going to have.
What about the thing with the math?
25,000. It's a very interesting thing about the math, because each time they speak about the math, they don't speak about our paper 3, which is actually a paper that is designed for young people who wish, for example, to take your engineering at university or take a subject at university level that enable them to take those areas. Instead, they choose the mathematics papers that are the 1 and 2 papers, which are also papers of a standard but that have a particular purpose around them. I think that's a curriculum matter which I'm talking about. The fact of the matter is that we had 3 different assessment tools last year. Once there were questions about our mathematics paper, and 3 independent bodies that looked into this, and that includes Umalusi, actually disputed the fact that the standards of the mathematics paper were low. We accept that there must be debate in this because it's an area that we are working on, but we don't have a crisis in that regard. Again, we've got 104 exams that we said last year. If we have a debate about the math paper and one math paper of the 3 papers that we have, that can't be used as an indicator for there being quality or not. That must be used as an indicator that there are areas that we still need to work on, but not necessarily to cast doubt on the credibility of the examination system as a whole. And that is our argument. We are not denialists here. We are not saying that everything is fine. We are saying we are working together with higher education in these areas, and we are succeeding. We are very happy that there is clarity from Prof. Yes' input that is indicating that the ILOF report is fundamentally flawed. And I think that all of us agree with that. The pilot that we did is for these papers that are reflected there. It's for accounting, economics, English first, additional language, paper 1 and 3. It's for history, paper 1 and 2, hospitality studies, life sciences, paper 1 and paper 2, math, paper 1 and 2, math literacy, paper 1 and paper 2, and physical science, paper 1 and 2. So when we are speaking about the benchmarking tests that we've conducted internationally, these are the areas that we did, not the entire curriculum. So we will accept, for example, criticism in other areas as well, where there is evidence that we do not have. But in these areas that we have benchmarked with more than 5 world-class bodies, we didn't go to benchmark our papers with bodies that are unknown. We went to Cambridge, we went to New South Wales Board of Studies, we went to Scottish Exam Council. Those are some of the best. We went to Kenya, we went to Malawi, we went to Zambia, some of the best in Africa. These benchmark tests that we have conducted internally, they are actually very clearly indicating, if you look at the difficulty level on your extreme right of the presentation, you can actually see the kind of conclusions that internally we make. Now, these are the conclusions that are not our own conclusions. These are the conclusions that are made by the reports of our benchmarking that are actually, by the way, Chairperson, available, that are accessible, that are not a secret, that are in our website, that you can also go take, read, and make an error. We don't have any problem with it. We work with it. If you look at accounting and economics on top, considered very difficult. relatively easy certain papers. Now remember that these benchmarking tests were not the exam papers that we wrote. These were a preparatory, that is the sample papers that we sent to schools, which our analysts have said that more than around 50% of the exam was based on those. So you will actually again look at it in that context. But the point about this is not to argue per subject what is the standard of our curriculum and the assessment system in each of the current of there, but it is to make a point that we are not sitting not being worried about ensuring that standards are looked into, that we work hard to make sure that these are addressed.
But what are you talking about when you're saying we need to address problems? I look at that level and I see very difficult, good, difficult, very difficult. There's two that are relatively easy, which is all English, which has nothing to do with the math that we are talking about now. So what is it that is of concern to you with regard to the math?
I'm not concerned about the math.
Okay.
Those who are concerned.
It's higher education
that is concerned.
Let me ask this of Professor Young. These things are now benchmarked against these international peer organizations and so on. Your test that you conduct, what kind of benchmarking was done at any, or if any, with those benchmarking tests? I know you did allude to some of them.
The benchmarking was within the higher education sector, etc., looking across the sector at first year. And we were quality assured by Michigan and by the Educational Testing Service of Princeton, New Jersey, of extensive experience. So there's a lot of benchmarking. Then can I just ask, I'm really interested in this and I'm very impressed. Is this on the final exam papers?
No, this is on the exemplar
papers. Thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
Yeah, this is on the exemplar papers, and all of us agree that the exemplar papers, like it's the practice internationally, Cambridge, for example, will publish what they call an exam syllabus, which is a kind of a broad area that indicates what kind of a sample, in terms of standards, that can be expected. These are very comparable to that. And the important thing about them is that they were set by the very same panels that set the exams, and moderate them.
Is there a correlation between your exemplars and your final paper?
What's the rate of deviation?
At least
50%. Yeah, at least 50%. But there were some challenges, particularly in math, some of them were quite different. The final exam.
It was quite different from the exam. Let's get clarity on it, because I think this has been a big issue. Was there substantive deviation from your final math papers from these exemplars that both in terms of mathematical literacy, paper 1 and 2, math paper 1 and 2, and I don't know, you alluded to a math 3, paper 3, I'm not sure what that is. Maybe you want to also speak about that. But in terms of the deviation, what was it from this?
Penny, you want to comment about that?
Yeah, the maths was very similar. In fact, there were some criticisms that were too similar. The science was very different. In fact, the science paper was so much more difficult than the exemplar paper that many teachers commented that the exemplar had misled them. There's always a reaction. This little panel that sits there, they put out an exemplar, the teachers go crazy, they say the physical science is too easy, and they swing to a little bit too difficult. This is why finding our feet. But I think the point that this issue is making is that we really try to make sure that we benchmark it at appropriate levels and use this to guide us. We don't always get it perfectly right, but we need to say that this year I think that the physical science will be probably a better predictor of higher education success than the mathematics at the top end. We're working on that.
I think that reflected on this graph is on the table there, which in terms of color, classification, you would be concerned with your language, for example, in that I think we have reflected in that. But I think that we also look at the number of critical items in a question paper versus the number of items. We also look at the cohort would love a chair that we also take cognizance. We are having this debate today on the mathematics, but we also have looked further than just the mathematics. We also have looked into language issues around this. And we have a report that are there. We will release this report at some point. I'm not going to get into the detail of it, but the fact of the matter, we also have looked into the impact of question papers, because we are aware that in a country like ours with multiple languages, there are issues around language. But we don't want to manage the language issues carelessly, knowing that it's a sensitive national question. But the fact of the matter, as a department, it's not a matter that has eluded our gaze in as we prepare examinations. I would like to conclude at that chair, and if there are any questions from what I said, I would gladly like to answer. If I were to just say one word, I would just say that I'm very pleased that we have made the kind of progress that we have made over such a short period of time. Just 5 years ago, examinations were set in provinces. Just 5 years ago, they were set in provinces. Within 5 years, more than 128 exams, which is the entire curriculum, is set centrally, nationally, which means you can now say, if this paper is of the standard, that's a national standard. Now, there's so much we can speak about here. And the presentation by HESA hasn't disagreed with it. And let me tell you, we wouldn't have achieved this without also their participation in this program. These international tests are not the only one. For example, this investigation that I'm talking about has been done by the University of Pretoria on our behalf. So there is a continuous engagement between us and higher education on this. That's why it was so alarming for us to hear the head of the chairperson speaking so off in terms of what actually is happening. And yet he has someone who speaks directly in our panels and is actually representing us and is aware of all of the things that I'm talking about. I would congratulate this debate, and I would like to request that some of these things be moved to our structures of our department, because we do have structure. And I want to indicate that if you want to make an impact in terms of the standards of our assessment, take into account the fact that exams that I'm setting this year are exams for the next 3 years. I'm done with these exams that we're going to be writing now. I set them 2 years ago. So it's 18-month cycle in terms of how we write. So it's not helpful for any input coming from our partners in higher education to not meet us at proper structure to discuss it, so that the input informs the output in terms of the quality that we're running. But I would really request that we look into it. We work well. I think we are succeeding. I think that this debate today contributes on quality improvements going forward. But I'm warning that we have structures that are the IPEC, the Interprovincial Examination Council, that involve all the 9 provinces, that involve structured advisors, that involve assessment specialists in the provinces. We want to make an impact, not in an exam, we want to make an impact at school level. We don't want a high standard of matric that doesn't exist in the classroom. Yeah. We would like a standard of matric that is reflected in all classrooms in South Africa. And that can happen if we are obsessed with the matric. And now we are probably introducing another standard that is another matric to some extent. But that would be the least, I would say, that is negative about the presentation that Prof has made. And I think the rest of it we support. I would ask you, any standard debate in South Africa must be informed by the values of access, the values of quality, and I haven't heard anything about it. And the minute you introduce any benchmarking test, you are actually getting in the way of access, unless you explain yourself. Thank you, Chair.
Okay, I see a number of hands, but let me just try at this point to just summarize where we are in this debate so that we take it forward from that point, right? I think I would be correct to say that ideally we would want a single assessment of school leavers to inform both the extent to which the learner has achieved a general education in school, to inform whether that learner is university material, technicon material, or no material at all. To inform the extent to which that learner is going to be able to cope at any particular faculty within any particular higher education institution. Ideally, that is what you want out of an assessment exam coming out of school. The difficulty, as I see it, relates to on the part of higher education now a huge problem with regard to the throughput of their students once they arrive at universities. Particularly, I imagine the same is true for technicons, in that learners tend to not cope with a three-year degree being achieved in 3 years, more often than not. And a finding, at least in some universities, that there is a genuine need for bridging that gap between schools and a very much more focused and intensive and perhaps independent way in which students have to learn at universities. All of which, by the way, doesn't necessarily mean that the general education received at school is of an inferior quality, of inferior standard or whatever, but that students are required to perform at a level more suited to independent study and so on. Now, there are other issues in South Africa that are peculiar, which is essentially your language and culture issues, which I know our colleagues at the Portfolio Committee on Higher Education have been looking into quite a lot, is the issue of the cultural gaps that exist between our schools and our universities in particular, where students just feel completely unable to engage in a way that students are supposed to engage. People don't feel able to approach lecturers and so on. Those are cultural legacy issues that they would deal with. But in terms of language, clearly there is a difficulty, as Professor Feltz was saying. Most of our students are operating at second and third language levels once they get to university. I'm not sure to what extent, though, that, you know, and we'll get to that issue of language now as well. But essentially, that is where we are. And what we require, from my perspective, having heard all of you, is a more determined effort at engaging what is required at the level of your higher education, at your higher education institutions, that is perhaps not catered for at the level of our schools. And how that bridging can happen while not compromising the specific focus of schools, which is general education, as opposed to higher education, which is very specific kind of faculty-based, course-based education. So we must recognize that difference between a general education and a very specific kind of focused learning experience that is completely different. And for me, as I said to you, I mean, my sense is that in many countries of this world, there is that bridging phase, whether it's built into the curriculum, as you said, the four-year degree as opposed to a three-year degree, which allows courses to be held on note-taking, perhaps research methodologies, all of those things. I imagine would feature in those kinds of bridging courses. Those things are not uniformly part and parcel of our education system. We have a high education system, we have a school education, and somehow students are meant to find their way between the two without any formal kind of assistance. And this is essentially what HISA, I think commendably, was looking at when they required these benchmarking tests. Clearly, these utterances on the part of individuals, and as I say, it's hearsay because I wasn't here and I've read it in the papers just like everybody else, that our students fresh from school are unable to read, write, spell, all of that, that's clearly just a complete, shall we say, misstatement. Whether on the part of Professor Eloff or the media, I'm not sure, but whatever the case is, it does cast unnecessary doubt as it pertains to the standards of the exam, as it pertains to our schooling and so on, which is not to say that there aren't challenges, of course, at our schools, which is something that we will look at. But this discourse is about those students who have performed well in our schooling system, who are at universities, and what their requirements are. And clearly there are those bridging gaps that need to be spoken about. Now, that's where we are in this discourse, members. Let's hear. I saw a number of hands, but I also saw some hands here. I think it was Professor Felt.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very brief. I just want to say, in case I'm sounded as I said what Professor Eloff said was absolute nonsense, which would be very... I haven't actually read it. I just said, in fact, our results don't show... You know, exactly what you said. They indicate there's a challenge. But so I would like to see those results, but I don't want to just contradict them without having seen them, but that hasn't been our experience. The second thing I wanted just to say quickly is that just to remind everyone that, in fact, we didn't actually go to the press, yeah. Mr. Sishan, that, you know, we actually tried to actually, when people who were going for OBE said, oh, you know, it's shown by the National Benchmark Test, we said, hold on, we're talking about different things here. So I hope it's not construed that we value our relationship with working in the department. And just what can I say about the maths paper 3 issue, just to be, because I think higher education is between a rock and a hard place on this. Papers 1 and 2 are what the subject is that's called mathematics, and paper 3 is paper 3. I can't remember what it's actually called.
Math paper 3.
Okay. But when students produce mathematics paper 1 and 2 mostly, our problem is that as a higher education institution, or all of us, we can't put into our entrance requirements that students must offer paper 3, which is what we'd like to do in engineering, because in the paper 3 is a whole lot of things engineering needs. But if we did that, we would be saying that students who are at schools that can't offer paper 3 because they haven't got the teachers to teach it cannot get access. But from the DOE's point of view, and I can understand this completely, they would like higher education institutions in some way to say you must do paper 3 because that would put pressure on the schools to begin offering it. So, I mean, this is something we need to sort of resolve between us, because we found ourselves unable to say to the lots of schools who can't do paper 3, you can't come, sorry, to UCT or to WITS or to wherever it is, a Forte and that, because you haven't actually been at that school.
But do you differentiate when you do these tests, assuming it's for the purpose of entrance now, not the issue of support, do you differentiate between those students who have done paper 3 and those who don't? Or do you just put all of them through the test, and then if there's an incongruence between the two, then they suffer the same fate,
Chair,
as those?
We don't test anything that's not in paper 1 and 2 for that very reason, because otherwise we'd be cutting out all the students who couldn't do paper 3. And it's a system problem if we don't have enough teachers who can teach the paper 3, and that's why it was halved off. So between the two of us, we've got it like we want the same thing, but we can't do it without...
Clearly there needs to be a discourse on that issue as well, because it can't be, you see. For me, I worry that what we, you know, with all of this benchmarking and all of the exemplar processes and so on, I do think that they are you're going to find, if I say to Professor Eloff, for example, to give me all of his first-year students who can't read and write, and I go and I say to the department, let me see their matric results, I'm going to find that they were reading and writing on those papers, if you're with me. And likewise, it seems to me that if we say that for you to get into engineering, you need X capacity in terms of mathematics, then schools should know this, and pressure will be put on schools to provide that level of maths, because clearly, I mean, the one question I had was, if we have law students and students in the humanities who are writing the maths exams, I tell you what, they're going to bring a percentage down, right? You wouldn't have that. So likewise, if you're going to want students to perform at a particular level, then that is what you should be measuring, really and truly. And if there are problems around those students not performing at a level, then we can say, ah, okay, there's a big challenge here. But if we're saying, well, we need a level that we subjectively say needs to happen before the chances of success would be okay, and we do it testing paper one and two and some other things that we think that, you know, should be there, that worries me a little bit because of that element of subjectivity involved there. Well, I mean, you said it's paper one and two and those other things that you test on, that are specific.
We don't test anything that's not in paper one and two. But we might not ask the question in the same way. But everything there is in paper one and paper two.
Just go back to your... Oh no, you're not on there. Okay. No, I thought you said paper one and two and a whole system
from a higher education perspective, but only on paper one and paper two. Okay. We don't have anything in there that isn't in the curriculum.
Let's be clear about that.
I'm not quite sure.
It's not the same as what's in paper one and two. It's what's in the curriculum.
Yes, exactly. Correct. Absolutely correct. But presumably paper one and paper two is based on the curriculum.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm very confused. You know, for once, I would like a straight answer in education. You know, something one plus one is two, right?
Are we testing? Look, man, if we're testing what paper one and two has already tested in the matric, why are we testing it again?
We're getting different results.
But then the question is, what is the problem there? And if Mr. Shishi is saying to me that actually the assessment is completely above board, we've got processes in place and so on that show me that the assessment cannot be compromised, then what are we saying is the real problem? If all we're doing is testing paper one and two.
Look, by definition, of course, any examination paper can only examine a selection of the curriculum. Yeah, the curriculum is in fact a three-year curriculum because it runs grade 10, 11, 12. In the end, you can only examine parts of that curriculum. I think that is understood. So it could be that if you test one part, you're going to get a certain result, you test other parts. But in fact, of course, it's deeper than that. It's the way the questions are asked, as Ms. Vingerfalter said, the context in which they're asked, the time at which they're, you know, all of those factors can, of course, influence these kind of things. They shouldn't, quite honestly, on a sort of global systemic level, but they're going to influence, obviously, individual things. But, Chair, I would have to say I think that might be part of what you've called for in terms of a more determined engagement. I think between higher ed and ourselves, we need to sit down and, as Mr. Shishia said, let us interrogate from the side of HE, the SBTs, let's look at the methodology behind it, etc. Let us comment on that in the same way, clearly, they will be looking. And I think through that process, Chair, we should be able to certainly come closer. But again, I would still reiterate on the basis of that last slide, that I'm not sure that at an aggregate level we are in fact getting different results. As I say, the trend line on that graph I think would have very closely mirrored the trend line in terms of the SPT. So, we would need to look at that, but as I say, that's part of the engagement, I think, Chair.
Well, particularly if we are setting exams now for the next 3 years,
yeah.
Because then if there are problems in terms of the two speaking to each other, that's going to perpetuate into the future. And I think what I'm going to do at this point, DG, is to leave it with you and say to you that we will reconvene at this level with Professor Vitt and others. And I must just say up front that we invited Professor Ehler specifically to attend today, and he wasn't too accommodating, but I believe that that is why you're here as well, as was through his efforts. I'm not quite sure. But you know nothing about his tests. I'm not quite sure how that works. But we will invite him yet again. But to say to you, perhaps in another month, we will reconvene at this point and require from you an input on your engagements with both the benchmarking test and HESA generally. So that we have more, shall we say, unanimity about these kinds of issues, because I do think that if we're testing the same things, we shouldn't be getting the same results. And perhaps you guys are the ones to interrogate why that is. It could be the thing that I was saying, where you know people don't take it as seriously as the matric exam, and so they're not preparing sufficiently for it. I mean, I know when I did my matric, which was like donkey's years ago. When you finish your matric, you've achieved everything you wanted to achieve, and it's party time, and everything from now on is downhill. I mean, that's the attitude of most students. And I'm wondering to what extent that is a factor. Maybe other factors. Maybe language issues, because you were saying you put a lot of effort into translating question papers, whereas now you're dealing with the language issue at the second, third language level. Maybe all other kinds of issues. But what I'm saying to you is we need more determined answers and definite answers on some of these questions. And it may be that you still have divergent views about some issues, which is why we're going to invite both of you back here. But I think the engagement is going to result in a lot more, shall we say, certainty on this matter that we're now debating. Right? Let's hear from members your comments about this and other matters. Ms. Dudley?
Thanks. Obviously, we've heard the chair mention she would prefer to see one assessment at a school level and that ever. I want to know if the department has a problem or does higher education, where does the problem lie in terms of if there's more than one assessment? Because my logic would tell me that you could get a clearer assessment out of the both of them, and I'm not so sure that it's a problem, that there's a bit of a discrepancy, because I'm thinking somewhere between that you get a picture of where that person really is. So that would be my thinking. What I was going to ask...
But Cheryl, the issue then would be about entrance into higher education. If it's about support, that's quite fine that there's two.
Yes,
but if we're going to say to a student, you're going to need to do something to get into a university, surely you need one instrument to do that and not two.
Well, my thinking would be that the university wouldn't block someone on the basis of that exam alone, that they would take into consideration the school exam and that exam. That would just be my thinking. So I would hope that it wouldn't be a blocking thing, but it could well be a guiding thing, college is better for you or this or that, because you do see people floundering or whatever. So I'm just thinking, because my main question was going to be, but I've heard now some indication that there is. I was going to say, does the department actually feel they understand what higher education is saying? I mean, is the department still foggy about what it is that higher education are actually getting at, or do we understand it? But I think the question really should be, does higher education feel that the department understands what it is that they're getting at? And I'm thinking that's what we need, because what at the moment we're getting a sense, although in this last little bit of interaction I'm seeing a little bit more of a grappling with that. So yeah, so it's just seeming hazy to us, because we're not sure yet, because it's no good saying what we want or feel we should have, because we're not the academic, we're not higher education or the department. We just really want to know that you absolutely know what little signals are going off in their area, and that they know that they've communicated that well enough.
Yeah, thank you, Chairperson. I would like to go back once again to the results of the NBT. And
the three sort of result points that were made. And although there was an effort from the department responding to the one issue to say maybe your standards are too low, the department to a certain extent that, you know, responded to that. But on the other hand, I didn't get it clearly from higher education to say because of this result that you stated there, maybe that you are too high, your expectations are too high, or the bar of your standards or the quality that you want is too high. So in the engagement, maybe that is the sort of thing that needs to be ironed out and talked about.
Mr. Smiles. You see, I can't sit here and allow an unfair question because that was not the finding. It wasn't about high and low. The third element of the assessment that the professor presented to us was a question around whether the full curriculum was taught at schools or whether emphasis was placed on one or other areas based on exemplars and other kind of coaching experiences. There was never talk about high or low. That's my difficulty with the question.
Okay.
So.
All right, Chairperson. Let me just get the page. And I don't want us now as a committee to differ. But for the sake of being a unit, as a basic education are being questioned, and that's my interpretation, by higher education of what is coming towards the university. That is the clear message that we must get. And maybe this is the result of what is happening in our classrooms. So it goes back then to the Department of Education to say, higher education is saying this about you. You should be stepping up what is happening in the classroom. Then we will be able, basic education and higher education will all be able to make sure that the end user of our children, which is the labor market in the end, will get a quality or a citizen or a person that will be able to be accepted without question or with little, very few questions about this person coming into the labor market. I think that is all of us, is our work, including this portfolio committee. And I think that is the important thing. But I can stand here today to say there are definitely quality issues in our classrooms that needs to be addressed. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah, no, I don't think the department would disagree with that last statement, but certainly in the way that you phrased the other issue, I would phrase it in a little more nuanced way after this debate. We could have possibly said it in that way earlier on, prior to this debate, but certainly now, when there's clarity being given on both sides, I think there needs to be a little nuance. But let me not answer for you. I saw Mr. Benefort's hand, and then I'll give the professor and anybody else who wants to respond to either of these inputs here from members.
I mean, I don't think we want to give the impression that today we're grappling and we're in disagreement. We've been working together with Higher Education South Africa since 2005 on it. We knew this was coming. We supported it. We welcomed it. We provided the curriculum. We provided the exemplar papers right from 2006 so that higher education could do this. But what I think we are uncomfortable with today are two things. The first is that we see the graph going in the right direction. In other words, we don't see that there is this huge difference between what our exams are telling and what the other exams are. But we have to keep in mind that last year 600,000 young people wrote the matric exam. We prepare them for further education, citizenship, parenthood. When we start to talk about particular aspects of mathematics, in 2009, 5,000 students across the country were enrolled in engineering programs. Now, we have to be careful that we don't start to run an entire system on the 5,000 students, that we differentiate, that we talk about paper three, that we talk about the particular concepts, not to exclude, but to say the paper three will give you the edge if it goes into engineering. But we're getting very, very mixed signals. Wits University, for example, tells us that those students, both who did the IB exam and who did the state exam that did paper three, don't have a particular edge in the June exam. We need much more information. So here are the Department of Education's two concerns about the benchmark testing. We're not foggy about it. We know exactly what it is. We welcome it. But if we're going to start to say that this exam is secure, this test is secure, and we can't see it, then we're not going to be able to feed back into our system for teacher training, to improve our curriculum. We can improve our exam because we know that at the top end something went wrong in the math. So that's our number one concern, is give us you don't have to give us a test, but you have to give us greater feedback about the concepts that we need to teach more deeply. And that graph, that last graph, tells us a lot of things, and that's what we are also asking for. Let's trace those students, and let's see if it's at the teacher level, did those kids have extra lessons, what was it that put them at the 80% level right up. So we want more information to improve the system. The second thing that we're concerned about is the purpose for which these benchmark tests are going to be used. Our understanding, and the only reason we supported it from the beginning, is that they would be used in order to be able to provide support, and that was why they were run in March. Our concern now, when we hear that they're going to be run in September and that they're going to be used as a double edge, when young disadvantaged people do not know what the curriculum is, what's in those tests, and they come and sit it at UCT in September, they don't know what it is, it really starts to churn up the system. I mean, you could get the unintended consequences, kids saying, why should I go to school? Why should I get my national senior certificate? With all the benefits that has, and start to try and second guess what this test is, which it sounds as though higher education is not going to put out. And I mean, we would say at least put out some items so that the kids know what's going to be in there. And so our concern is, what was the purpose of the test? How will it be used? Will it be used in its original intention to support, or will it be used to exclude? And that we would be worried about.
A few things. Number one, I think to Ms. Dudley, you know, the principle of using additional information, not just one test, is very well established in the higher education system. For example, the Health Science Consortium, any student wanting to go to study health sciences in the country has their entrance score made up, a percentage of it, 40% of it or 60% of it, depending which university, from the National Senior Certificate. Another 20, 30, 40% of it, depending on the mix, from what's now called the alternative admissions scores, but they are read the NVTs in a way because it's taking over. So there's a whole lot of the higher education system uses the National Senior Certificate as the eligibility criterion, and then things are built on top of it. That's a well-established practice, and that's what's happening now, and the NVTs are taking the place of that in some ways as being a more rigorously designed set of tests. So that's not a new thing at all. And it's in the statute and within the autonomy of higher education institutions to do that. So that's one thing. Second is this: is the bar set too high? As I said, I did try to say this as well in my presentation. We don't think it actually is set too high, given what's being reported to us. But what we're saying now is that the proficient one, if one takes in the top half of intermediate, to safeguard in case it is at the moment, and so we all understand it better, that actually will give very good safeguards, because then you're only looking at lower, intermediate, and basic, and it's very unlikely that that's okay. So I agree with you. In fact, one always has to. It's the same with the National Senior Certificate, exactly where you set an 8 or a 7. Will we get the same results even if we tunada and work together closely with the DOE? I don't think we ever will get exactly the same results, and I'm sorry, Chair, that I wasn't clear about it, but I think the DG said it very well. We're looking at the things in the curriculum, and the higher education practitioners, and I emphasize again, drawn from all the institutions who are teaching first year, are looking at what are the things in that curriculum that are particularly important in that domain in higher education, and asking questions from that perspective. So they're not expecting content knowledge above paper one and paper two. But we are asking from a different kind of like purpose, and so it's quite likely that we'll have slightly different results. But we shouldn't contradict each other, but they won't be exactly the same. There is a need for both kinds. Security, I certainly didn't mean to say we wouldn't actually share all these with an exactly the template of what percentage of everything is built in, and we must work, and I look forward to that. I just was saying we won't be putting them on the website, because we actually, we have to have 6 or 7 papers a year that are equated, etc., and it's just too much of a risk. I think that's basically what I wanted to respond to.
So one thing that must also be pointed out is that sometimes, just as much, I mean, I'm looking at this graph again, and I see that sometimes you have kids who have passed their matric maths and got, 85-odd%, but when they did this test, got less than 20%. So that's a rare occurrence, yeah? Likewise, you have kids who got over 45%, almost 60%, you've got a kid here who's got over 60% and would have gotten less than 60% in the matric. So it cuts both ways, isn't it, in terms of the extreme. And most of them, I think the point that Ms. Vinfort was making was that the majority of those dots are somewhere in the middle. So there's strong correlations either way, and perhaps the deviations are slighter than one would ordinarily say. But be that as it may, whatever the case is, and whatever the reasons we're attributing to the differentials, because that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the differentials in outcomes. The fact of the matter is that there are these differentials. Now, either it's showing us some very, very deep flaws in the way in which the two tests are not necessarily complementary and not necessarily assessing the same thing, or it's showing us that, at any given time, if you give the same test, people will get different results. Now, whatever the case is, it's something that the educators need to, and the experts, because that's what you are here, all of you, experts in your respective fields, need to iron out and need to decide how to then process forward. I think I would agree very much that we start devising these tests more and more to show where the gaps are and where the support is needed, but not necessarily only around the issue of entrance qualifications, because I do think that if the argument is that we need support, then you can't argue that people are just going to fail because they can't do the test. So I think there needs to be those two ridges, there needs to be some input both from higher education and the department. May I just say that I think, and I'll give members an opportunity here to comment finally, but my impression is that a lot of this is because we both kind of at an early stage of assessments. Firstly, for the first time, you have a national exam, which, by the way, 5 years ago, as you pointed out, we had different exams in the country. So clearly, we're moving forward in that direction. As far as standards is concerned, I, for one, I'm quite satisfied that what can be done about standards has been done. Benchmarking it against other international bodies says to me that I go to sleep at night saying to myself that our matric exam is fairly secure in that sense,
and that there's no real crisis about that. However, clearly there would be a need to bridge the gap between your schooling and your university. If you just look at the issue of focus, general versus specific, clearly there's a need there. But if you consider that in schools, you go there, you have a teacher who gives you notes, you take down notes, explains to you when you don't, you have a constant interaction between your teacher, whereas in university, that's independent study. And clearly there needs to be, I mean, even if we didn't have the kind of language problems, the kind of cultural issues that we do have coming from the legacy that we do have as a country, clearly just that in and of itself would indicate to any rational person that there needs to be a bridging space provided for students coming out of our school. But given all of our language and other cultural issues as well, and certainly the issue at our higher education institutes is very, very prevalent, the issue of a cultural dilemma that faces our kids. Those things taken into consideration would obviously mean that you have some huge challenges which need redress. So on that note, I mean, I would say that that's my preliminary view. What we're saying is go away, and DG, we're leaving that to you, and it doesn't matter that higher education hasn't come to you. We're saying to you to reach out to them and meet on these and other issues, which should, by the way, not just focus on the issue of the academics of the whole thing. It should also take into cognizance the issue of language, the issue of culture, and so on, and how those things need to be redressed in terms of bridging at university from school. And then you will, within a month, all of you return and give us some sense of those discussions, because my sense is that Mr. Shishi certainly came here with a different expectation to what he's heard, and I think he's very relieved that what was said was not the intention certainly behind these tests. And I'm very, very interested in the idea that Professor Falters has postulated here, which is that at higher levels you will need a space for that kind of acclimatization, let's call it acclimatization and support, which is something, by the way, that happens in other countries. You know, we're the ones with a three-year degree and we expect people to just run in the first year, when in fact most countries have four-year degrees or other kinds of mechanisms that take care of that bridging thing. So I do think that we're not alone in that sense, that those challenges are faced across the board, but that we must also take cognizance of the fact that we have a legacy that we can't just write away and say, well, every other country also experiences the same problems. We have to deal with them very, very specifically, whether they language, whether they other issues and so on. Which is not to say, DG, that this is the end of our discussion on our challenges at our schools, because that is a separate issue. This, as I say, I try to contextualize on the basis that these are students who have made it at your matric level, who have now gotten the exemption pass and who are in the system of higher education, who then need that bridging support. We're still going to have a long discussion about the issue and challenges at our schools, and I see that some of our officials haven't participated sufficiently in this debate, simply because I guess we were expecting a different outcome out of this discussion. But that discussion will still happen. What our challenges with regard to certain schools, with regard to standardization in terms of teaching, in terms of the quality of education that we're receiving, in terms of the literacy and numeracy levels in our lower grades and so on. Those things are all, so we're not even talking about the kids who are not succeeding at school. This is talking to kids who are succeeding, which is a big issue. So we're going to have that discussion quite substantively, and certainly we'll have detailed hearings. But I don't know if you do want to say something. Go ahead.
Thank you. Just a small point. Just to say for us, the discussion is very, you know, very beneficial, because what we're looking at is a total system. the focus today has been largely at matric level, but that kind of feedback, you know, happens at all levels of the system. We hear how learners who come from your foundation phase aren't sufficiently prepared for the intermediate phase or for the senior phase throughout the system. But what makes such research valuable is that then you get feedback on where you can strengthen, what you can do, what quality you should be looking to really build on lower down. So this has been a very useful discussion indeed for all of us. Even in terms of, I mean, one of the explanations that we put here was perhaps not sufficient coverage of the curriculum. That occurs at all levels of the system. In fact, what we're strengthening now with the lesson plans lower down in the system is to ensure that the curriculum is covered in every single grade. And that's a problem that we face across the system. Thank you.
Now, that's certainly a discussion that we're going to have on an ongoing basis. In fact, we're going to plan hearings around that particular issue and other issues of access and so on. So I just wanted to point out that this is not the end of that discussion and that this is a different discussion, really, from that discussion. I wanted to actually close up, but I see two members who have comments. I've got Ms. Mshishi and then Dr. Klopas-Lurin.
I just have one question. As to say, really, I believe paper through of mathematics will do more good to our learners. Do we see in any future to the Department of Education having paper three in our matric exam being compulsory? I know there are these challenges that you are saying you are having of teachers offering that and that, but I think that those should be the things that you are planning around as to, do we see our matric learners sitting for paper three, all of them? Because really I believe that will make a great difference of them entering those university levels that they are expected to do. Thank you.
In connection with the exam panel, what criteria is used for the compilation of exam panels? You refer to subject advisors and academics, but I'm very worried about the fact, I think you should also have teachers who are in the classroom to be part of the panels. And apart from that, my second question or comment is that I think we should revisit Mr. Smiles' remarks on coaching specifically. Mr. Mashishi said they guide and prepare students or pupils or learners to obtain skills in preparation, but there are different definitions to coaching. And I really do think some teachers do drill in questions and answers, and it gets set in exam papers with a slight change, and that does definitely have an effect on the results. Thank you.
Madam Chair, the criteria are there, and I think the strongest one is the second one, the experience as an educator. In fact, you have to be teaching grade 12 at the time, so there's no question teachers are involved in the setting of the exam papers. Moderation goes to higher education, but the setting, no question on that one. I think we can have an ongoing debate. As you say, the meaning of coaching can mean many different things. I think good coaching is probably very close to good teaching, and it should be encouraged. Clearly, the sort of coaching you're talking about is something that might help you get a slightly better mark in an exam, but it's not going to help you beyond that exam. So, yes, let's interrogate what the meanings of those. On the paper three, Mr. Zizhi, Ms. Pinnipal, do you want to comment?
I think that we must investigate this, and this is one of the things I think we need to have a discussion, because it's not as though it's all of paper three. What in particular in paper three would strengthen? But I have to reiterate, there are 5,000 engineering students in South Africa. We teach 600,000 students. What we'll have to do if we bring something in, because teachers already said that the curriculum is overcrowded, what do we take out? Do we take out financial math, which is preparing all our people to better manage their lives? You see, these are things that we would work with higher education and say what's best for the majority. Mm-hmm. But we certainly, it's in the forefront of our minds, what in paper three would be good for all our children, and then what would we do to prepare people better who want to study engineering?
That's the whole debate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
one of the questions then you need to say to yourself is paper three is preparing you to perhaps cope at the first year engineering level. What are you learning at first year engineering level if you had to do paper three in the first place, if you're with me? So those kinds of debates I think will be had at the level that you're at, because you're the experts on this issue. I don't know if anybody else has any final...
a final remark, Jay, and really thank you for having convened this session and Professor Yold also for attending. And certainly we've got, as I say, a very different understanding from what we had read in the media and what we came here prepared for. And I think, as you've rightly said, it sets us up, I think, for a very constructive engagement. We'll certainly have it. I'm a little bit concerned about the 1 month, Madam Chair. Sometimes these engagements, as you would know, are very complex and difficult, and we might need a bit more space than that. I'm noting, of course, that there is going to be another round of these in September, and it might be valuable, in fact, to report back after that. So perhaps we'll have to just assess it at that time.
I'm hoping that you'll engage sooner rather than later, yeah. Not just in because of the September thing, because of the question posed about what the September thing is used for in some institutions, but not necessarily all. But also the issue of the exams being set at a matric level without any sense of the outcomes of these discussions. That worries me a great deal.
Let's put it that way. Thank you, Chair. I think what you've also helped to clarify is that Professor Yell's research is not the same as Professor Eloff has reported on, and I think it is obviously a pity, it's a concern I'm sure to us all that he's not here. I do think perhaps as this committee we need to call upon HESA to in fact make a formal comment in this regard. He might say these were comments he made off the cuff, etc. He might say let's ask HESA for a written statement about this. I think it might just clear there a little bit on that one, but it's just a suggestion from our side. Otherwise, thank you very much.
Look, on that score, as I said, we've tried to invite him to the session, and he then referred, I think, where's Mr. Brown? He'd be able to give you a better sense of the various correspondences to and fro from Professor Eloff's office. At the same time, because his name was mentioned here and so on, we will certainly invite him to the discourse that we have in the next month. But in the meantime, if you can meet with him and clarify, you know, as Professor Yelg was saying, perhaps there is another report test done at Afrikaans universities predominantly or whatever it is that we have got no sight of. And we've tried to, because I was under the impression, I must say to you, that having read the newspaper articles, that they were indeed two distinct reports. But what I didn't get was that they had two distinct findings. And that's part of the reason we'd invited him here to explain to us what, and while we got certainly the National Benchmarking Project Tests report, we certainly didn't get a report out of his office of any other study that has been done. So if there is another study, I think that's the first starting point is for people to get it and then interrogate what it's measuring, how it's, and the way that we've done today with Professor Yelg. And all that's left now, I think, members, is for me to thank our guests. Professor Yelg, particularly yourself, I know it was very, very short notice, and we didn't get to sit down and chat at all. And so I do appreciate very much that you were able to make it and clarify some of the issues in the way that you did. I thought that the engagement was very constructive indeed. Likewise to the department. I must say that I thought that the discussion today and the conversation, hopefully, which will continue, was quite constructive, and I do hope that this engagement continues beyond the committee. But we certainly will already in the next week or so give you a date and time for the next engagement so that you can plan accordingly as well.
Thank you
very much. Okay, thank you, members.
Thank you,
I'm going to go to the hospital.